Good morning, all.
Psalm 126. I invite you to turn to that passage that will serve as our text this morning, Psalm 126. While you make your way there, let me thank you for your presence here this morning. We've got some folks who are our guests and especially grateful that you've come our way and shared something as precious and as valuable as your time with us, and hope that it will prove to be spiritually beneficial to you. I appreciate Josh's. That first selection was very appropriate in regard to yesterday. Seldom do we get that kind of a day here, where just sort of a lazy Saturday, rain all day, and just we needed the rain. We did need the rain. I hate that we got rained out, but this Saturday, we'll work to get our folks invited for the meeting that's upcoming with Mark Broyles at the end of the month, and hope that you're excited about that. There are some flyers, by the way, in the back for that meeting to help invite people, and I'll be sending out a digital something digital tomorrow to you to facilitate those invitations as well. We live in a world that is marked by despair and discouragement, by discontent and dissatisfaction. We live in a world of sadness and sorrow with very little hope and only rare moments of happiness. Happiness is defined, or at least one definition, as an attitude of satisfaction or delight based upon luck or some present circumstance or circumstances. In other words, happiness is related to happenings and in a sense is a matter of luck or fate or chance. Translated, you really can't plan on being happy. Happiness is an incredibly elusive animal that you may or you may not find. And tragically, happiness is the very best that men can do. But when we talk about joy, we are describing something that is entirely different. Joy is an attitude of confidence that resides deep within us no matter the circumstance. Joy is not a matter of chance, but rather is a matter of choice. And even a casual reading of the Bible, we find joy to be a very common theme in the Word of God, that it is to be a prominent part of a Christian's life. And yet, admittedly, consistent joy is a struggle. There are a number of things that frequently try and rob us of joy, circumstances being one of them, that when things are going our way, we're just a lot easier to live with. We feel a lot happier. But the truth is that very few circumstances are under our control. And therefore, if we depend upon them for our happiness or for joy, then we will spend the bulk of our time miserable. People also try and rob us of our joy. At some point, we've all been discouraged or hurt by something that someone has said or done or who they are. And no doubt, we have inflicted some of that same on other people. And so some arrive at the erroneous conclusion that the only way really to have joy is simply to isolate yourself from everyone else. But as Christians, God doesn't give us that liberty, does He? A third thing that robs us of joy is possessions, things, achievements. They can never be trusted as lasting sources. At the very best, they can bring happiness, a temporary satisfaction, but joy will never be found in the things of this world. And if there's a greater need among Christians today than joy, I'm not sure what it would be. But even among the people of God, we struggle to be joyful people. And maybe it's because we bought into some false notions, some misconceptions, that we think that joy is about natural temperament, that there are some we know who are just seemingly predisposed to being more joyful than others, that they're just sort of hardwired with a smile on their face. But biblical joy isn't a matter of one's natural temperament, and it's certainly not a matter of empty pretense. We're not talking about painting a smile on your face and just faking it, of ignoring all of life's harsh realities and acting like everything is fine. True joy isn't something that you can manufacture for yourself or for anyone else. But perhaps one of the most common misconceptions is that we think that joy requires a perfect situation. But the reality is we all encounter low points, challenging circumstances, periods of sadness. And so if perfect situations are required for us to experience joy, then the reality is we will experience very little of it. True joy involves two important components. Perspective, outlook determines outcome. Joy is controlled by how we think and our approach and our mindset. One is perspective, two is a person. That you cannot have genuine joy apart from the person of God. And that brings us to our text this morning, Psalm 126, the next psalm, Song for the Road. And as we read through this psalm, you'll see that it is very much a psalm of joy. And yet, it is also very clear from this psalm that for the one who wrote it and for the original ones who sang it, that they were no strangers to the darker side of life. Their circumstances when this psalm is written and when it is originally sung were far from ideal. Many believe that this particular psalm was penned after the Babylonian captivity and sometime during the restoration of Israel back to Palestine and in particular the city of Jerusalem. Events that are described for us in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And though we have read about it in the Bible, and though we have perhaps read some things from books of history, the Babylonian invasion of Judah, and in particular the city of Jerusalem, and the subsequent captivity after that, were horrific events that would boggle the mind and turn the stomach. This was not just a case of a nation being destroyed and their freedom being lost. It was a situation where there was open violence in the streets, where there was cannibalism that was taking place in kitchens. There were thousands of people that died by sword and by famine and disease. And if you were fortunate enough to survive, you then faced a 600-mile forced march across the desert to a foreign land where you would there be enslaved as captives. And with each step of the way, you would hear the taunting mockery of your oppressors. But even when they were allowed to return back to the land under the reign of the Persian Cyrus, they came back facing numerous obstacles. They were just a remnant who were small in number and thus small in power. The city of Jerusalem was completely in ruins. It would take years before their temple was finally finished, before the city was fully inhabited, before their fields were originally producing as they once had. On top of that, they were at the same time surrounded by enemies who sought to thwart their efforts at every turn. There were threats of violence along the way, that though they had returned physically to the land of their forefathers, there were times of difficulty and sorrow that they were facing at that moment and would face for years in the future. How could anyone in those circumstances experience joy? Psalm 126, beginning in verse 1. When the Lord brought back the captive ones of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with joyful shouting. Then they said among the nations, "The Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. Restore our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south. Those who sow in tears shall reap with joyful shouting. He who goes to and fro carrying his bag of seed shall indeed come again with a shout of joy, bringing his sheaves with him." What the psalmist reveals here is a joy that's not based on a person's genetics or on their circumstances, but instead a joy that is founded on what God had already done for them and their belief in what God would still do for them. You'll notice how the psalm is structured. You have the first three verses of the psalm, or the bulk of that section, in the past tense. They're looking back at how God had restored them and to the land of Zion and the response of joy that followed that. In the final three verses, we find that those are written in a future tense. That here is a prayer in regard to what the writer of the song and the singer of these songs were convinced that God would do for them in the future. And then right in the middle of the psalm, at the very end of verse 3, we find three words, a brief description using the present tense. We are glad. Joy involves all three of those dimensions. It's not something that's transitory or temporary. It's not some brief spurt of good feelings that happens to come along with sunny weather. Joy, true joy, has lasting power. And the psalmist reminds us, first of all, that it is built on the memory of God's actions. We can only imagine what it would have been like for the returning remnant, that they have lived for decades in a land of captivity. They have lacked both freedom as well as the liberty to worship as they once had, as the nation had been accustomed to, and the discouragement and the despair that must have overwhelmed them in that situation. And we're not left to guess about that. Look at Psalm 137. In Psalm 137, we get some insight into their feelings during the time of their captivity. In Psalm 137, beginning in verse 1, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. For there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, 'Sing us one of the songs of Zion.' How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy." And so get a feel for the situation as it was in Babylon, and then envision them now in Psalm 126. Having been set free from captivity, free to return to their homeland and to once again celebrate the feast and to enjoy the land that had been promised to their forefather Abraham. And the writer says that experience, that restoration, filled them with joy and with new life. The phrase there in the New American Standard, "brought back" in the Hebrew, describes a turning is how it is. It's talking about a previous condition that had been once marked by blessing and fulfillment that had then at some point in time gone wrong, but the Lord had now restored it back to what it had once been. When the Lord brought them back, the ESV uses the word "restored" the captives. There was a sharp reversal of the harsh reality of their distress, and the writer says it was like a dream come true. That phrasing there of the dream was sometimes used to describe someone regaining their health after an extended illness. It looked like they were going to die, but now they're full of life again. When we went to College Station two or three weeks ago on a Wednesday night, we stopped at a convenience store just outside of Waco. And I was making the purchase. There was a kid that was there. He was probably in his early 20s. And, you know, so I walked up to the counter and I said, "How you doing?" And with heavy sarcasm, he said, "I'm living the dream." The psalmist is living the dream, but there ain't no sarcasm in it. And the dream that he's living doesn't involve a new car or a vacation home or a new wardrobe from Nordstrom's or financial prosperity. He's living the dream because he's been brought back. He has been restored to what he has been designed to be. "Sing the songs of Zion," their captors said in Psalm 137. This is a song of Zion. Fortress, castle. And as we talked about last week, originally it referred to that Jebusite stronghold that was maintained by the Jebusites throughout much of Israel's early history, only captured during the reign of David. Originally just a thumb-shaped crest that was located in the southwestern section of the city of Jerusalem. Here it seems to refer to the entire city itself. But you'll notice as he moves from verse 1, where we find a joyful relief conveyed, that he quickly gives way to a much greater exuberance in verse 2. "Our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with joyful shouting." This is not some small tweak of the lips. This is not a polite chuckle. This is not a snicker that takes place hidden behind your hand. This is a burst out loud, slap your thigh, tears rolling down your face, laugh out loud, belly laugh. And you'll notice it's not just his laughter, it's our laughter. That upon their return to Zion, the mouths of God's people, he said, were filled with laughter. The idea, the imagery there of that terminology is that there wasn't any room for anything else. Their tongue, he says, was also filled with joyful shouting. This is not some subdued celebration. This stands in stark contrast to the feelings that we saw, the expressions in Psalm 137. And it's exactly what the prophet Jeremiah predicted in Jeremiah 31 in verses 7 and 8. For the Lord says, sing aloud with gladness for Jacob and shout among the chiefs of the nations. Proclaim, give praise and say, O Lord, save your people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I am bringing them from the north country and behold, I will gather them from the remote parts of the earth. And we see that fulfilled also in Ezra, the historical book that tells us of their return to the land of promise. In chapter 3 in verse 11 and verse 13, all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. The people shouted with a great shout and the sound was heard far away. Psalmist says it was like we woke up from a dream and we understood that it was reality. That we were recovering from an illness that we thought would kill us, and now we find ourselves full of life. Even to the point that their Gentile neighbors were compelled to admit that Israel's God had brought about an amazing deliverance, that He had brought about this incredible transformation, that Israel's return from the land of captivity was even the talk among the nations. And that's not to say that these nations would come to a point of faith in Israel's God, but that they recognized that someone or something supernatural had been at work to achieve something that would have otherwise seemed utterly impossible. It would be similar to people's responses today when something happens that they can't explain. They're very quick to label it a miracle, but that doesn't mean that they're committed to being true believers of God. And at the end, in verse 3, the Lord has done great things for us. It's interesting to me that they simply restate what the nations were saying. It's as though the people of Israel are saying, hey, we can't say it any better than what the Gentiles have already said it. Something extraordinary has taken place. The second part of the psalm, the smallest part, just three words in the New American Standard, that there is gladness in God's person. We are glad. The present tense statement in the psalm, and it lies right in the middle of it. The translation, by the way, glad, seems a bit tame given the circumstances. That what God had done for them in the past brought them an incredible sense of joy in the present. That every act of God seemed simply too good to be true. There was no way that it could ever happen, and yet it had happened. What those words remind us of is the fact that joy has a history. Joy has a history. The psalmist and those who sang this song filled their hearts and their minds with memories of God's actions on their behalf in the past. Their joy was based on something as real as a date in history, as solid as a layer of rock in Mount Zion. But as he moves forward, he tells us that it was also nurtured by an anticipation in the future. That earlier divine intervention simply served as an encouragement for them to believe that God would intervene again. That if God had worked with us in this way in the past, then there is no reason for us to suppose that He would arbitrarily change His way of working in the future. That just as joy builds on the past, it also borrows from the future. It expects certain things to happen. And so beginning in verse 4, the writer transitions from the first section to the final section. As he looks out into the future, we see a prayer that God will restore their captivity, is how the New American Standard translates it. NIV ESV renders it with the word fortune. Restore our fortunes. Even though they have returned to the land of promise, everything's not lollipops and rainbows. Circumstances are still less than ideal. And when you read the books of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah, you find that they face numerous obstacles and opponents and frustrations. And it reminds us that joy is not destroyed or inhibited by those things, is it? But another secret is that it's found in hope in God's promises. Restore our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south. Those who sow in tears shall reap with joyful shouting. He who goes to and fro, carries his bag of seed, shall indeed come again with a shout of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. Here the writer employs two images to encourage the people to persevere. That as they pray for a full restoration from the captivity, it seems that the greater the difficulty, the more their resolve must increase. The greater the joy when that petition is finally realized. The first image is one that's common throughout the Old Testament. The streams in the south, or in the Hebrew, the Negev. And it was, again, a familiar image of topography and climate of the region. The Negev was the south. It was a vast desert area that was cut into sections by water erosion into a network of wadis and gullies and ditches. And for most of the year, the Negev was baked dry under the intense Palestinian sun. But then there would be an extraordinary transformation that would take place often during the winter. That when it would rain up in the mountains and the water would make its way down through the ditches and the gullies and the wadis below, and those wadis oftentimes would be turned into raging torrents of water that not only worked to replenish the water sources in that area, but would often set those wadis ablaze, at least briefly, with a variety of greenery and flowers. And what a marvelous image of the prayer that he is praying here to restore the previous condition that is now dry and desolate in Zion, that is, they look to rebuild and to restore, even in the face of hardship and opposition. May our difficulty give way to greenery and flowers as you turn the Negev into streams. The psalmist is confident in his belief that God's actions on their behalf would be repeated, that he would bring a renewal of their parched lives. The second image is that of involving this long cycle of agriculture. It begins with the labor that was involved to plow and to plant. It's difficult, it's frustrating, it's sometimes disappointing work that can sometimes result in very meager results, especially when you think that they have been gone for decades and now they are coming back and they're cultivating land that hasn't been cultivated for several years. To plant anything is an act of faith, isn't it? And in spite of the challenges, the sowing continued. And the psalmist's belief that the result would be a shout of joy, third time, by the way, that Hebrew word is used in the psalm, that there would be the excitement of the harvest, that perseverance would pay off, that struggle would eventually be replaced with celebration. The prayer, the plea, is that those who sow in faith would shout with joy at the harvest. That those who perhaps went away with heavy hearts would come home with joy and with blessing. That the end, however, cannot be known. It can only be trusted. And you'll notice here that laughter does not exclude weeping. Joy is not an escape from life's difficulties or sorrows. Pain and hardship come even to the joyful. But we find here in the psalm that they're not robbed of their joy because their minds are fixed on God's great works of the past and His marvelous promises for the future. What a marvelous couple of metaphors to describe the reversal that takes place when one moves from a difficult present, perhaps marked by fear and anxiety, to a blessed future marked by abundance. And by the way, the harvest that he's describing here is not so much a harvest of wheat or grain, but rather a harvest of people as they are restored from their captivity. To this point in our study of the Songs of Ascent, we've typically seen more of the darker side of emotions. We've been reminded through them of our need to plead for God for His help. But in this psalm in particular, we come to a much brighter side, don't we? We're reminded that we find our joy not in our circumstances and not in people and not in things, but in God. We find here the joy is not found in eliminating the things that hurt us. It's not found in numbing the pain or being lucky enough to escape hardship, and it's certainly not found in depersonalizing our relationships. Joy doesn't come in a nice, neat little package. It doesn't result from a prescribed formula. It's not something that you can go out and purchase or work up on your own. It's not about feeling good about ourselves. All of those things are temporary at best. None of it lasts. How can we have a joy that outlasts circumstances and possessions, that's not hinged to happenings, that's not destroyed because of people? The psalmist's answer is that that kind of joy comes only from the Lord and who He is and what He does. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, they were out camping one night. And Holmes woke up Watson in the middle of the night and he pointed up at the stars. And as Watson blinked the sleep out of his eyes, Holmes asked him, he says, "What are you able to do to deduce?" And Watson replied, "Well, astronomically, I deduce that there are billions of stars, millions of galaxies, and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, I'm able to deduce that Saturn is in Leo. Chronologically, I'm able to deduce that the time is approximately 3:15 a.m. And meteorologically, I'm able to deduce that tomorrow will be a sunny day." And when Watson finished, Holmes, he asked Holmes, what about you? What do you deduce?" And slowly and thoughtfully, Holmes replied, "I deduce that someone has stolen our tent." Joy is sort of like that, isn't it? It's simple, and yet at the same time, very complex. Like we see in the psalm, joy is filled with both laughter and with weeping. And surely as this song was sung by those pilgrims who made their way to one of Israel's great feasts in Jerusalem, as they sang these songs for the road, there were many of them who sang this song whose lives were filled with hardship and pain. And yet there was also joy and praise. And it wasn't dependent on their circumstances, and it wasn't dependent upon other human beings, and it wasn't dependent upon what they owned. True joy, it isn't dependent upon good luck and somehow escaping all of life's trials. It's not dependent on good health and avoiding pain. Biblical joy takes place in the midst of pain and loneliness and suffering. That's what makes it different from happiness. Turn, if you would, to the Gospel of John. Let's finish with this. Three passages from the Gospel of John in the final night before Jesus is crucified. And I want you to notice what He was communicating to His disciples at this particular time. Let's start in John chapter 15. John chapter 15, Jesus is in the upper room. He is preparing for His death, His arrest that will take place later that night, His death that would transpire on the following day. And notice chapter 15, John chapter 15 and verse 11. Jesus says, "These things I have spoken to you so that My joy may be in you and that your joy may be made full." Skip down to chapter 16. Chapter 16, let's begin our reading in verse 16. John 16 and verse 16, "A little while and you will see Me no longer. And once again, and again, a little while and you will see Me." Some of his disciples then said to one another, "What is this thing He is telling us? A little while and you will not see Me, and a little, and then again a little while and you will see Me, and because I go to the Father." So they were saying, "What is this that He says? A little while. We do not know what He's talking about." Jesus knew that they wished to question Him, and He said to them, "Are you deliberating together about this, that I said a little while and you will not see Me, and again a little while and you will see Me? Truly, truly, I say to you that you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will grieve, but your grief will be turned into joy. Whenever a woman is in labor, Whenever a woman is in labor, she has pain, because her hour has come. But when she gives birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish because of the joy that a child has been born into the world. Therefore, you too have grief now, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, and no one will take away your joy from you." And then in John chapter 17, that great prayer that we're studying on Sunday nights, But now I come to you, and these things I speak in the world, so that they may have joy, My joy made full in themselves." Who God is, what He's done in the past, and what He promises to do, especially through Jesus Christ, should put, like the psalmist, a laughter on our lips and a shout of joy on our tongues in the present as we proclaim, like the psalmist, we are glad. Perspective in a person. Those are the things that provide us with joy that circumstances can't take away. People can't rob. And it's not built on things or possessions. This morning, if you're not in Christ, understand that Christ is the only source of true, lasting joy. And so if you're not a child of God, no better time than now to come to Him and to know the joy of what God has done and what He promises to do so that you can have joy in the present. Or maybe you've done that, you haven't walked as you should. No better time than now to rededicate yourself to Him. If we can help you in any way, won't you come right now? I want to get a stand and sing.